Hello and welcome to Build with Bitcoin. In today's episode, we speak with Jose Lemos, CEO of IBEX. IBEX has been one of the main players in building out Lightning Network infrastructure, and they started out in Latin America and have since been expanding. We hope you enjoy the conversation, and as a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Build with Bitcoin. Today, we're doing something a little bit different. We're an in-person interview, and it's our real great pleasure to have Jose Lemos with us from IBEX. He's the CEO of IBEX, and he's here with us. We're doing this live in Mexico City. Israel is with us virtually from Miami, so we're going to try this out, and we're so excited to have you, and I think it's going to be a great conversation that you and I get to be together in person talking.
I think to start out, I mean, we want to focus most of our conversation today on IBEX and your whole journey with IBEX, how you got started and the products and services, your investors, your market. But before we get started, just to learn a little bit more about you, Jose, can you share with us how you became introduced to Bitcoin? You're from Guatemala originally, and how your journey began and how you started, how you came up with the idea to start IBEX?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to be here with you in Mexico. And I'm so happy that we got to do this in person. I do a lot of podcasts and usually, you know, I'm somewhere in the world that's not podcasting friendly. So have to jump in on Zoom or whatever. So getting to do this, it's a real treat. To your question, how I got started with Bitcoin, I really got started when I read the white paper in 2012. It captivated me. Me being from Guatemala, like I understood the value proposition immediately of like Bitcoin, the asset. What took a long time, and we'll get into this, I guess, is more Bitcoin the technology, right? Because we had a little bit of a snafu there with the whole calling Bitcoin the database and Bitcoin the asset, the same thing. I think made it the technology a little bit harder to understand that it needed to be. So anyway.
And this was 2012.
This was 2012, yeah. Yeah, so remember, I come from a country where when I read something that you couldn't confiscate and you couldn't print away, it was music to my ears. Like Bitcoin going up in price is a bonus. I just needed it to do the first two things. I didn't need more price. But price is a progression of adoption, I guess, right? As more, it's an indication really, as I see it, of the economic fundamentals. So people always ask, like, Bitcoin isn't backed by anything, or that's the critic they say, right? At least back then. Some people still do it now. But my argument is Bitcoin is backed exactly by the same thing that every currency in the world is backed by, which is the economic activity of its participants. The difference between Bitcoin and, let's say, most currencies is that Bitcoin, it's willing participants, and the rest of the currencies, you're kind of coerced into having to, you know, use the quetzal, use the dollar, use the euro. Like, you don't get a choice or a say in the matter. Bitcoin is opt-in, opt-out, but still, fundamentally, it's backed by the economic activity of those of us who participate on it, right? So anyway, got a little bit sidetracked there.
No. Because yeah. I think it's really important to understand. I mean, I saw it first as a technology, mm-hmm. but I think that might be the difference between having a currency origin in Guatemala versus, even though I was living in Mexico, coming from the US, so I was involved in technology and I didn't see that currency part of it as much as I just saw the transactionability that it facilitated.
So at the start, what we started doing was like putting out like a bunch of ideas up on the board, like what can we do, like events, you know, like Bitcoin education, Bitcoin, and we were fooling around with this, and then we realized if there are no on-ramps, there's nothing. Because I remembered as a Guatemalan not being able to get access to Bitcoin. And then even if you had Bitcoin, you couldn't do anything with it in Guatemala other than save with it, right? And so I told, you know, we came up with my brother with this idea that we want to go and give access to Bitcoin to the region, Central America, mainly. And we foolishly started out like, you know, let's build our own exchange. So we hired some devs. We tried to build our own trading engine and everything. We promptly lost like 75K on that, on the engine thing. So, and then we realized, okay, we have to make this go somehow. This thing is not going to work because it was too hard to get people to create markets. And we didn't have the capital to create a liquid market for Bitcoin. And we didn't partner with somebody to create a liquid market so that there would always be, you know, offers on the buy and sell side. Mm-hmm. So the offers we had were just really peer-to-peer and no volume. So that's why I said it just it was dead in the water.
Well, this is really interesting because like a lot of startups, it takes some time to find your path and to find your product market fit. Mm-hmm. So you knew you wanted a company, you knew you wanted to be in Bitcoin, and you weren't sure exactly what that was. I just want to kind of fast forward for an audience who doesn't know what IBEX is today, but you're one of the premier providers of Lightning infrastructure, which is a layer two on Bitcoin. It allows the usage, better usage of Bitcoin. So you provide this for institutions and enterprises. Yeah. So you've gone from trying to find product market fit. I just want to get these entrepreneurs who are listening kind of excited about the fact that you can kind of go on different paths, but where you are today, I mean, you're really recognized as one of the leaders of enterprise and institutional services for facilitating transactions on Bitcoin via Lightning. Is that fair to say? Is that, did I sum it up correctly?
We like to think we got the best Lightning solution out there for institutions specifically.
Yeah. And why would an institution need this? And I love the idea that Bitcoin payments, where institutions generally use big payments. I mean, I think there's two sides. There's the big side and the little side. So institutions moving large amounts of money, there's solving problems that way, and also having problems with tiny amounts of money, and you solve that also.
Yeah. So to give you an idea, we really see the LMPBP as a tech stack. So that, for those of you who don't know, is Lightning Network Protocol, Bitcoin Protocol. And we equate that to the TCP/IP protocol. We just see TCP/IP is for, let's say, this type of communication that we're having with Israel today, right? Where it's a more regular communication, but the LMPBP tech stack, we see it as ideal for financial communication. Because what you need in terms of financial communication is you need something that's inalterable, so immutable, and very, very safe, right? But that everybody can access, so everybody can verify, especially financial institutions. I think that people are not aware, broadly speaking, how fragile financial institutions are. But they do go under all the time. It's, you know, one of those things that most people don't know, but I kind of learned that the hard way when our bank, you remember the bicycle company, the bank we were banking with went under, and we lost a year and change of profit. We almost went under ourselves, and they went under because Refco, a financial company in the US went under. So that's the whole chain of events. And this happens all the time. So our thought process is, if we can leverage this tech stack, this LMPBP, as the internet of money, right? And we're able to connect financial institutions directly together in a trustless manner, then we can open up a whole world of very interesting opportunities. So here's the thing. Most of the account holders that had money in the bank in Guatemala, and even some of our money that was held locally in Guatemala, that was recovered, so to speak. Gonna use air quotes here. It was, bought out by another bank, and then the other bank now gave us that same amount in our new account. But the problem was that at that point in time, because Guatemala does not subscribe to the One China policy, so we recognize Taiwan as a country, you couldn't send money directly from Guatemala to China. And so you were forced to set up an offshore account. Now, we said our bank had an offshore entity in one of the islands, I forget which one. So what we would need to do is we would need to send money from our Guatemala local bank account to the offshore bank account to then send to the Chinese company.
And these are probably issues that thousands or millions of companies all over the world. I mean, we tend to think in a very, those of us from the US or from Western, governments tend to, we have an operating financial system, but there are so many individual businesses and countries that don't have the same facilities. So IBEX allows a more seamless transaction ability, capabilities.
Yeah. Now, not only more seamless, so I'm going to go out in the future here.
Okay.
So to everybody listening in.
I love that.
let's go out into the future, because it's not where the technology is today. But this is where I firmly believe it is going, right? So for those of you who don't know, and we can talk about this a little bit, in the world today, and I'm going to get a little bit philosophical. I hope that's okay, right?
Perfect.
So usually with new technologies, what you see is a large disruption in basically three things. Your currency changes, so the way you exchange value changes. The other thing that changes is the way you organize socially. So your social structures change, aka governments, right? And your commercial structures change. So how you engage in, let's call it commerce, right? Now, there's been a couple of these technologies along humanity's, trajectory that have really changed things. And we call them revolutions. The first one was the agrarian revolution, right? And we went from largely nomadic tribes, which used, seashells or whatever, as a mere value. And they had tribes as their social structure, no real currency to speak of. No, the commerce was between family members, so to speak, to this world where you started to have these feudal institutions when people became sedentary. So, kings and those types of things got, now this is over a large period of time and there's a lot of bleed through, right? Because we did have nomadic tribes at the same time as we were having some type of kings, right? But the world started migrating, right? And that was the first one. And your money changed from these tokens, so to speak, into, specie, right? So grain, or cattle, or metals, or something that had enough utility, salt, that you could exchange freely. you know, after that, we had the mercantile revolution. And this came when the boats, you could actually travel long distances. It made the world smaller as well, right? So each of these technologies makes the world smaller. Then you have the industrial revolution. Now we're in the midst of the internet or information revolution. So our structures are changing. Yeah. The first ones that change are the commercial structures, which is super interesting because business is usually the first to adopt anything new, and specifically illicit business is the first to adopt new technologies. It's an odd thing, but so we're in the midst of this. And so far, most of commerce has migrated online. You know, one of the things that the internet happened, we're in the midst of the digitalization of most products and services. Most, if not all, will end up online, right? Government is one of the last institutions to adopt new technologies. So it's kind of like you have the technology companies, the first to adopt technology. Well, illicit technology, they are in the same boat. Then you have more established businesses. Then you have education. Then you have government. And I think after that comes financial, or finance is in between that. They're about the last guys to adopt technology because it's too risky. And so right now, finance is still working very much within the old industrial revolution paradigm, the hub and spoke model. And we want to migrate it to the information age with the network model or the peer-to-peer model. Now, peer-to-peer doesn't mean person-to-person. It means equal to equal. And so who needs to move value the most, globally speaking? Well, financial institutions, banks, multinationals, you know, those type of people. And so who is the equal of a fintech, another fintech, right? And that's kind of our playground.
Israel, I want to give you a chance to jump in here because I know that's your background exactly, is what Jose is talking about here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thanks, Jose, for all the interesting background as well on, you know, what got you to eventually the product of building out infrastructure to scale these payments, right? And I think what you touched on just now is interesting and spot on as far as technology adoption coming, you know, kind of being bottom up adopted, and you naturally get some of the larger and more regulated players adopting it maybe at a later stage that's de-risked. I think we also see that geographically between developed and developing countries. Can you speak a little bit to, Jose, as far as I met your co-founder Esteban about a year ago, and you know, you guys had already been well established by then, and he was speaking to some projects you had going on in Mexico, of course, with Grupo Salinas. He was also speaking towards doing something in Brazil, and of course you have a strong presence in Latin America in general. Can you speak a little bit to some of the differences in technology adoption to when looking at emerging countries versus, let's say, the US, Europe, more larger and developed economies? What draws your attention there?
Yeah, I think for me, it's all about pain point. So what we have to remember is this is a network effects type technology, right? Which means the more people that use it, the more valuable it becomes. And in business, I have this axiom, which is you can only charge for that which you're adding value to, right? If you're adding no value, you're going to have a hard time selling. Now, the problem with, you know, network effects technologies and businesses as well is that they're really hard to get off the ground. Like a lot of people think, oh, a network effects technology, oh, it's great. And because they see this S curve, right? Oh, and we hit that inflection point and then everybody's rich. And yeah, but the problem is that the the section that just comes before that looks like everything is dead and nothing is happening. And why? Because the value that you're adding is too low. But like, you know, the perfect example is how much value does only one telephone provide? If there's only one telephone in the world, it's useless. And not only that, it's super expensive to build because super expensive. As you add telephones, you know, becomes more valuable. The same device. And so now, right now, we're in that section, that first section of the S-curve before we hit the inflection point where we go parabolic. And then there's the other inflection point where we go logarithmic, right? So it's, and before we go parabolic, where it looks like it's nothing. So everybody's going to say it's dead, it doesn't work, it doesn't solve a problem, whatever. But what you have to do and what we're there trying to do is we're looking at the pain point. The only people that adopt those network effects technologies before you hit inflection point are the guys that experience some severe pain of some kind. It can be financial, doesn't have to be. Sometimes it's philosophical, like, oh, I hate the US dollar, I'll buy Bitcoin, right? That type of thing. But there's some pain there, whether it's financial or philosophical or otherwise, the people that adopt that in the first section. So we had to look at who has the most pain, right? Because that's the places that this place, this thing is. Where can we solve a real problem? That's the question we ask ourselves. And so I'll give you an example. There's no way or very little chance for a fintech to emerge from Guatemala or Central America. Like, very little chance. Why is that?
You have to work with the existing.
Not really. It's because the markets are fragmented. So they're very small. So in a region the size of maybe the half of Texas, something like that, you have five different countries with five different currencies. Markets the size of $20 billion, which doesn't break even into the Fortune 500. The whole country. And fintechs, by and large, are volume-driven businesses because your margins are tiny. These are basis points, right? You know, 50, 20. If you have a business that you're able to do 75 basis points and it's a fintech, you're doing great, like top-tier business. How does that grow in economies that are that small? The answer is easy. They don't. They die before they can even get any traction, no matter how good the idea. Now, what we figured is a way to leverage this technology to melt those borders away. So now we can go to fintechs in the LATAM region and say, it doesn't matter if you're from, you know, a little country like El Salvador, where it's $20 billion economy, or a large country like Brazil, which is $1.5 trillion, right? You know, multiple orders of magnitude be bigger. And we can say, we can help you deliver your product everywhere in LATAM.
So IMEX actually, your client are the fintechs in the regions. And so that's why where fintechs in the US may have the scale. So they don't need the help as much today, but LATAM as a market for you has tremendous potential, and it's a really easy problem for you to solve.
Well, we think we can also unlock a lot of value, stranded value, right? Because enabling these cross-border value movements, or let's say hooking these companies into the Internet of Money, we expect that's what's going to happen. Like I said, this is in the future. This is what we're looking at. And the reason why, let's say somebody in the US or Europe doesn't have this pain or wouldn't necessarily care about this is because, you know, to your point, just Miami, it's a $300 billion economy. It's more than 10 times bigger than El Salvador. It's eight times bigger than Guatemalan market. or something like that. That's one city. What problems are you going to have there? You know, it's very little. So, yeah, I think that's kind of like why we're born where we're born and how we approach things. And it's about building that this kind of system where you know, first it's going to be these fintechs and financial institutions and multinationals that are going to leverage this technology, we believe. But at the end of the day, as we go forward, and this is where, you know, it's really exciting for me, is that I really see this as a changing of paradigm, where we're going to be switching from, you know, batch financial processing to real-time financial processing, because the technology just works significantly different than what we have right now. So what we have right now, and in the hub and spoke model, the most efficient way to route financial transactions is to accumulate as much value as you can and then send them over in one single transaction. It's the most efficient way. With our technology.
And
yeah.
Sorry to interrupt there, Jose. I just wanted to make a pause because just to highlight the, I guess, the significance of what we're talking about, right? I mean, you're talking about moving from an economy, a global economy based on a closed network that operates as batch processing, to a global economy, which is where we're heading to, right? Being able to operate on an open network with final settlement, right? I mean, that's a pretty
powerful,
massive shift, right? In terms of maturity, there's still a lot to get to. I know, you know, we're very early in this, and there's still some reliability issues as far as the Lightning Network. But who are your customers today in LATAM, and why are you able to offer them, and why do they see value in these payments through a layer two solution in Bitcoin, when it's not necessarily the, you know, let's say 99.999, whatever that is, reliability in more, you know, mature B2B financial institution to financial institution payments, you know, like why is there, despite that, still value in this technology right at this stage?
Just to, okay, there were a bunch of things there. Let me start with the first one, which was, and I don't blame you because I missed on this a little bit for a long time, and it was where I was heading. It's not just the openness. And it's not just, you know, the real change, I think, is going to come because we're going to be able to go to a real-time financial processing. And it's not just the settlement, but it's that real-time flow of financial information that we're going to enable. That is the huge paradigm shift, because it's like moving from batch instruction processing, which was where computers were born, to real-time instruction processing. So real-time financial processing, because we like transactions, the smaller they are, the better. They are de-risked from a bunch of aspects, from, you know, the amount of value that you're transferring. And so in this world of real-time financial processing, what becomes available, right? Because this really changes everything. Because let's say you can do very interesting things, and we're not there yet, but imagine this. You can, if throughout your supply chain, you have this system of real-time financial process, transaction processing, you can set it up so that the Coke that is sold on the corner store immediately gets paid back all the way throughout the supply chain to Coca-Cola. And why is this important? Well, now Coca-Cola has real-time information about where their products are being bought and sold. And what this does, it improves your financial projections exponentially, but also, and more importantly, you're manufacturing projections. So this is where my background as a mechanical engineer slash industrial engineer comes in, which is the way you hedge against uncertainty of demand is you do it through, you know, inventory management. So you have this concept of security inventory, meaning inventory that you have in one place to hedge against future demand in case they need it, because you don't want to lose the sale, right? And all of these models are based on your consumption projections and financial and manufacturing projections, because these are very expensive production lines that you have to switch on and off, right? And so those models, the closer you get to real-time consumption, the better they are going to be. And remember, these are multiple millions of dollars stranded in inventory throughout the world. And if you're managing to improve your, you know, inventory management, even just 1%, it is multiple millions of dollars. And so that's the kind of thing that starts to open up when we move to a real-time financial transaction processing world.
That's talking about physical products, which is a huge unlock. And the other part of that is the unlock for digital products or services, which I've heard you talk about and give the example of, maybe you can share it with us again, but of Spotify could be a client of yours. Yeah. And how would that look in a digital world? What could IBEX services do for Spotify?
Well, yeah, this goes to the whole idea of micropayments and nanopayments that we had talked previously, right?
Which just is a subject I just get so excited about.
Yeah, me too, but most people don't care about it. But what I like to say is that as, you know, the internet evolved and our products became digitized, right? We started to, the really good thing about that is that the cost of production goes really, you know, becomes really low, right? And the cost of delivery of products becomes really low, right? And so now you're almost kind of only having to pay for like the really core product, the value add. But the problem is as that goes down, we hit a lower bound limit because of our payment system and out there. And so you got into this monetization problem. Because you were delivering, let's say, so little value that you couldn't charge for it, not directly. And so, you know, all of these imperfect monetization models that we have today rose up, and you have the ad revenue model, which you are the product. You have the, you know, subscription model, which leads to subscription fatigue, because at some point you get 10 subscriptions and you're not subscribing to anything else, right? Or put in your number. Then you have the prepayment model, which I like to call the you'll never see this money again model, because there's no way to get it out, that value. So whatever you put in, that's your entry fee. And the worst one, which has come along recently, is the whole metadata model, which is the world's patterns and the world's, you know, consumption is for sale. And it's being used, you know, to manipulate elections.
Data, yeah.
So
with the IBEX model or Lightning Bitcoin payments, yeah, you can pay
micro and nano amounts. Like right now, for those that are not aware of this, in the Lightning Network, we actually already have millisatoshis. So we, you know, we hit the satoshi, which is 0.0006 cents, something in close to that, 0.005, I don't know, somewhere in that range. We go 1,000, so we add 4 zeros to that first 3.
But this allows you to process payments in real time in those small amounts for whatever the digital product is that's being consumed. So it's
exactly,
only, it's value for value.
Yeah. So yeah, and so in the Shopify example, what would be really cool
Spotify.
Is, or Spotify example, what would be really cool is without having to necessarily become a member or, you know, give my personal information to them, which is the other interesting part, I could potentially start streaming a song and be paying by the second and be paying fractions of a cent per second. If the song costs, let's say, 10 cents, right? And I pay just fractions. But that then gets multiplied and multiplied. Like, I'll say this. I would be willing to pay per search I execute in Google if it's low enough. Like, if you charge me 1 cent per search, no problem. And then I don't need the one thing I would ask if I'm paying, my metadata data doesn't get sold and my ad revenue, and I get shown no ads. So,
yeah.
And we can move to that. But where it gets really even more importantly, like it's going to be more important, I think our technology, and I'm speaking here broadly Lightning Bitcoin, but more, you know, I really see it as the blockchain technology. We are the technology that is needed to fully unlock the value of AI and IoT. So we're very complementary technologies because we can enable, you know, payments per compute cycle, which is super interesting. And now we're getting into some esoteric realms here. But my philosophy is that AI models, the more they manage to specialize, the better they will be. Like if you have an AI that is just focused on doing video, it's going to get really good at doing video, not really good at much else, right? Kind of like people as well, right? The more you specialize at something, the better you get at it, right? And so if the best AIs, right, are going to be the most specialized, well, at some point you want to, you know, buy other AIs are going to want to buy products from other AIs to deliver to, you know, the person who's on the other side of the keyboard. So if I go into whatever, give me an AI.
OpenAI. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I go into OpenAI and I type it in and I say, can you make me a video with this? Instead of OpenAI that understands the text prompt that I want a video, but they know they're really crappy. They kind of are doing it with DALL-E, which is kind of like a sister, whatever, yeah. But they could actually ship this off to like a really good video AI and get it back and pay for the compute cycles. Yeah. You're going to want to have AI, you know, if it gets really sophisticated, like, you know, interacting with IoT devices instantly, right? Like if the AI, without you having to, you know, notify them, they are managing, let's say, and here's very important. A lot of people think retail, I always come at stuff from the business perspective. So my scales are different than most people. So some of these technologies are very interesting for institutions, not that interesting for individuals. But imagine this. You have a big 100-story building, right? And it's an office or commercial building. So skyscraper or 60 stories, right? And you're that is a lot of electricity that goes on through there, right? If you could have a managed, you could have it managed by an AI system interfacing with IoT devices and probably cut your electricity expenditure by 80%. And that's where it gets really interesting. But you need to be able to pay the IoT devices in real time.
Yeah.
And the AI has to have a native currency from the internet, which this is. And so, like, yeah. This is where I believe we're going.
Yeah, so many opportunities, and it's so fascinating. We only have about 10 minutes left or less, so I want to devote some time to talking more specifically about IBEX, yeah. Where you are in your growth. Israel, let me turn it over to you to ask some tactical questions for Jose to answer about IBEX, the company.
Yeah,
I love the philosophical part.
No, but thank you, Lynn. I think it's a perfect transition because so Jose, you've given us clearly, you know, a very good glimpse into the roadmap of the company and some of these, you know, new, all these opportunities and new business models that are yet to be discovered. You're clearly thinking a few years ahead, but as of today, kind of back to your point, Lynn, just, you know, so we give all the listeners a snapshot of what IBEX is doing today. You know, how many countries are you servicing? You know, what are of your existing clients? What are IBEX's products and services that you see in highest demand? You know, I guess, where do you see the next 12 months going for IBEX?
Yeah, so over the next 12 months, we're right now in the process of doing a collaboration with a company in Europe that's going to allow us to go into the European market and connect that to Latin America. Most people don't know how natural a fit it is for Mexico and Central America to do business with Europe. So there's a lot of synergies there that we can tackle by delivering lightning on both sides. We, of course, core focus right now is Mexico. We really believe in Mexico as a country, as a region. It's the second largest economy in Latin America. But even more than that, it's I see it kind of as the gateway into Latin America. Whatever, if you're successful in Mexico, you can export your product very easily to the rest of the region, very easily. Now, within my team, they get bored of me saying this, but I like to say we're in the bridge building business. Again, to the network effects analogy, our company or the value that we're able to deliver for our customers gets exponentially higher by each new region we're able to penetrate, right? So we're focused right now on offering our services in more of LATAM. We're bringing in the whole of Europe, which thankfully we managed to get this really good partner there. So hopefully be able to announce that soon. And just creating these types of opportunities so that our customers are able to grow, right? We're, the tricky thing about IBEX as a business is that we're not a B2C. We don't deliver a final product. What we do is we give you the tools to build your own product, right? And so it's kind of like the Apple App Store in the sense, but we're just the App Store. We don't sell the phone, right? And so imagine an App Store where, you know, we're not really delivering the products inside. We get other people to build them out. But the idea for me, I was asked this, you know, a couple of years ago, I was in a conference in Edinburgh and somebody asked, like, how do we know when we've won or something to that effect, like, how do you know when you're successful, right? And I said, we're successful when every financial transaction is getting done over the LMPBP and nobody knows about it because nobody cares. And that's the thing that is a huge realization when you go out from, let's say, I love Bitcoin, but I don't ask my customers to love Bitcoin as well. I don't need them to fall in love. I'm going to deliver to you so much value that you're not going to care that it's Bitcoin. And you're not even going to need to see that it's Bitcoin, not necessarily, not the way we use our technology, right? You're just going to be able to use it seamlessly and interface with anyone you want globally.
That's powerful. Yeah, and that's how the internet works. No one really digs around into the backbone of it. Everyone just communicates more effectively and shares information. And these are the tools, the foundational tools that allow you to exchange value the same way we exchange information today.
Exactly.
Let's say, so just recapping on IBEX, you've gone from a name without a concept to where you are today and operating and building bridges between now Europe and LATAM, and you've also been in the U.S. and we don't really have quite enough time to dig into all of that, but on the fundraising part of it, because a lot of our listeners are either entrepreneurs or they're investors, you have probably the a lot of the significant VCs involved in Bitcoin, supporting Bitcoin companies on your cap table. You've raised two rounds. Where are you in the trajectory and on that side of the equation?
So to date, we've raised, as you mentioned, $9 million on two rounds. I'm very proud of that. Very proud of counting a lot of the top BC Bitcoin, BTC VCs in our cap table. So very proud of that as well and happy about that. And, you know, as we go forward and we find these use cases, right? So we're going to, by necessity, be raising again, you know? So we're probably going to be putting together a round fairly soon, our next round.
Yeah. Do you ever see yourself expanding into more, into having partners that are more traditional VCs, if they can get their head around what this is? Because as you're explaining, it'll eliminate even thinking about the fact that you're operating on Bitcoin protocol technology.
Yeah. So, you know, we were born in that space, right? In the Bitcoin space. But at this point, we really consider ourselves more of a Bitcoin that is leveraging, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain as a technology. We don't necessarily consider ourselves a Bitcoin company, so to speak. Yeah, we deal with it and everything, but that's not where our core value is. Our core value is really unlocking the full potential of the blockchain to run financial transactions. And the reason why we choose the Bitcoin blockchain, it's not because necessarily we're Bitcoiners and rah-rah, though we are. The reason why we bet hard on the Bitcoin blockchain is because it's the only blockchain out there that offers the properties that we believe are necessary to even attempt this. It's the only one with the security. It's the only one with the liquidity. It's the only one with the proven track record of, you know, 10 years, 100% uptime. If there's any data guy out there, they know how incredible this is. Like if you're in DevOps and I tell you that I have a database with 100% uptime for more than 10 years, it's insane. You think I'm crazy. That's just how it is. Like no maintenance, no. Just keeps ticking. That's crazy. And so, and you know, the other important part here is it cannot be co-opted. A financial ledger, by definition, should be uncorruptible, right? If you're a financial institution and you are writing your transactions in a ledger that somebody else can co-opt, you're dead in the water. Like your model is, it's not workable. It's just not. And so for those reasons, so again, we identify as a fintech, or we a fintech supplier, if you will, and we will be raising from traditional VCs in the space, in the payment space. I think, you know, we love the people we have on board, and they have helped us so much in this last couple of years in our trajectory. But I think at this point in time, it's time for us to kind of like leave the nest, if you will, and go out into the world and bring in, you know, show the world how amazing the technology is, how it's gonna change things. And that means engaging with traditional VCs that are in this space.
Well, hopefully those will learn the values of the Bitcoin VCs, which Israel and I have had some great conversations lately with some of them, Ego Death, 1031, and just really feeling that the long-term vision that they have matches up with a company like yours that really has a long-term vision. So
Yeah.
Well, Israel, any questions and we'll go to wrap?
No. Yeah, no, I mean, I think we're getting close to the perfect spot to kind of wrap things up. But I did want to just mention there, I'm glad you touched on some of the whys you choose the Bitcoin, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain or time chain, Jose, because, I mean, I think it's an important point to highlight. And it's kind of a little bit of the thesis of why we, Lynn and I, decided to launch Build with Bitcoin, right, this podcast to begin with was, and you touched on some of these points precisely, you know, we do feel like there's just going to be this wave of new business models precisely because it's the most solid foundation, right? What you basically just explained is a great showcase of a business that's just has a very, you know, clear mind as far as what they need to build a business in such a massive market like you're explaining. And so highlighting those important foundations of the technology is you know, it's just kind of great to see and showcase. So, you know, it's also nice to see representation from Latin America on the startup side. Any comments or advice for others listening, Jose, since you've, you know, clearly had quite a bit of success so far with what you guys are doing?
I say this, I'll start with this. It's not for everybody. At this point in my life, I'm convinced entrepreneurship is not for everybody. It's, you have to realize it, right now when I was speaking, it seemed like small amounts, but we went a year without any sales, like zero. That when we were first starting out, and we got to a point where we already had lost 75K, and I put in 20 more K to kind of just have office space with no sales. My first times that I went to market to tell people about Bitcoin, I would get laughed out. And these were friendlies, by the way. I went first to my friends because I thought, you know, friends, they'll be nice. Nah. They were like, you are crazy. You're just wasting money. You're wasting time. This is a scam. This is any criticism you can think of, I got. And it doesn't stop, by the way. Everybody thinks, you know, you get to a certain amount of success, whatever, it doesn't stop. Like Elon Musk to this day, criticized.
Right. Yeah.
Mark Zuckerberg criticized. At some point during this trajectory, I even went and I said, you know what? Right now, how I feel about it is I don't care if it's $10 billion or $500 billion. If Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Jobs, Gates, whatever, whoever has that money, they earned every cent of it. Every cent. Like taking some, because even, you know, we've experienced success so far, but that doesn't mean tomorrow it's not dead, right? Like it's very fragile. These startups, right? We're still not out of the startups space or phase. We're still very much, we raised $9 million and it does sound like a lot, and it is a lot for, let's say, an individual, but for a company and trying to tackle what we're tackling, it's not that much. And we need to raise significantly more before we're even successful in completing this journey, you know? And so like...
But on the personal side, I mean, yes, you've explained the criticism that you get and the struggles, but there must be an upside. Why do you do it? I mean, what do you get out of it that must make up for?
The closest thing I can say, this is not something I want to do. This is something I have to do. The closest I can come up to is kind of like, this is a calling for me. It's kind of like, You know, I was reading this anecdote about when Zuckerberg got offered $1 billion for Facebook. And he goes to the board and says, well, this is just a formality. Of course, we're going to say no. And I think Peter Thiel is in the meeting like, hey, we still got to talk and think this through. Like, this is a, you know, a lot of money. And to you personally, because it was cash. It was a cash deal. This is like $100 or $200 million for you personally. Like, how do you walk away from that? That's a lot of money. Like, you can do anything with that. And he goes like, what would I do? I would build up another social network. I already have one. Why? Like, and that, not exactly, but it's kind of for me how it is. This is, you have to understand, I'm not doing this for the money. If you go into an entrepreneurship thing and you're building and you're creating something for the money you're going to get, you're going to fail. It's going to be too hard. At some point, the money you get elsewhere is better, because it is better, no matter how much you end up with at the end. And the things you go through are so hard. It's not worth it if you're not doing it for something a lot deeper than some monetary payout. And I go back to this. I think when we first started out this project with my brother, the thesis is we just want this to succeed because the alternative is too dark. The alternative literally is 1984, right? All your information at the disposal of fascist governments. Because when you're able to just kick somebody out of society by flipping off a switch, it's too much power for anybody to have. Anybody, and I do mean anybody, government or individual. And the risk is too high for that to happen. And I'm not even worried about evil people shutting their opponents. I'm worried about the incompetent government worker, which is governments are littered by, that mistakenly, you know, changes your name from Baristo to Baristo. Or is there no, you know, identity theft in this future world? And you now, somebody stole your identity, did whatever, and now somebody just shuts you out of the economy. You can't feed yourself. You can't live anywhere. You can't pay rent, mortgage, utilities. You can't even defend yourself because you can't afford an attorney. And because money is digital, and this is one of the things that people have to kind of wrap their heads around that. Today, money is digital. It's 97% of money lives on databases, 3% is cash. Money's digital already. We give those powers, which by all accounts is what they're going for, the risk is too high. So I'd rather, even if unsuccessfully, dedicate myself to this and avoiding that future, because not only is that so bad, the other side is so bright, like so bright. It enables so much. It returns so many rights that have been eroded away over the last 50 years or 100 years. I cannot not do this. Cannot.
Well, we're happy you're doing it. We're happy you're helping build the tools that enable this much brighter future. Israel, any closing comments, and we'll wrap it up?
I mean, I think that's a great place to wrap things up. And I guess, you know, just thank Jose for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you, Israel. Thank you, Lynn. It's been wonderful. And thank you for listening me ramble on quite a bit.
We loved it. Yeah. No, this is great. And we'll include all your contact information in the show notes. But is there anywhere in particular you'd like people to direct people to learn more about you or the work of Ibex?
Absolutely. Website powered by Ibex. If you're interested, you're interested in building a new fintech, a new type of fintech, that's your best source. Follow us on Twitter at Powered by Ibex. You can follow me personally as well if you like at JLLEMUS.
Great. Thank you very much. We really appreciate all your time and your ideas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jose.
Thank you, Israel.